All right, so I'm going to talk about cosmic rays, and I'm going to talk about galaxies, which we have not heard a lot about today. So starting with cosmic rays, what are they? They are charged particles. The name cosmic rays comes from the 1920s, I believe, back when they thought it was radiation and not particles. So they're charged particles. They are largely protons and helium. And then there's a little bit of heavy elements and so heavy nuclei specifically, electrons, positrons, antiprotons. So the basic idea here is that we have measured the spectrum at Earth. So the y-axis here in reality covers 20 or 30 orders of magnitude. So there's a huge difference between low energy, the intensity of low energy and high energy cosmic rays. So this starts at a GeV and goes to more than 10 to the 20 electron volts. And the basic idea is there's a population of cosmic rays accelerated within our galaxy. And so that would be things below the knee here. And that there is a population of cosmic rays coming from other galaxies. That would be things above the ankle. So it's a power law, right? There are power law components, but there are, it steepens at about a few times 10 to the 15, and then it flattens back out at a few times 10 to the 18. Also, there's a second E in here somewhere. I guess they'd named both of these beforehand, so you can't really pick a different body part at that point. And we know that these are extragalactic because the gyro radius of these particles is larger than the galaxy. And so we don't really know what the specific makeup of galactic versus extragalactic is between the knee and the ankle. Mystery, it could be an extragalactic component. They think at least in part the knee versus the second knee could be that this is where protons accelerated in supernovae and other things turn off, and then the second knee is where the iron nuclei get turned off. But that's definitely not certain. Okay, and the critical thing in the disk of the Milky Way is that the energy in cosmic rays is approximately the same as the energy in magnetic fields, which is the same as the energy in photons, which is the same as the energy in thermal gas and in the turbulent field structure. Equally important as all of these other components of the Milky Way disk. So the lowest energy cosmic rays are solar. So they're accelerated in the sun, and you get more of them when there's flares or coronal mass ejections. And the stuff that we measure at Earth depends on the solar modulation, so it depends on the solar cycle. So when the solar cycle is at its maximum, we get a minimum of cosmic rays, and when it's at its peak, we get when it's at its lowest in the solar cycle, we get a maximum of cosmic rays. You would think it would be the opposite. So it is in fact producing more cosmic rays at the peak of the solar cycle, but the magnetic fields of the sun that are projecting out are stronger, and they are basically shielding the Earth from cosmic rays. So we detect fewer of them during the solar maximum and more of them during the solar minimum. New results in the last decade. Voyager finally left the heliopause, and that allows us for the first time to measure the lowest energy portion of the spectrum of cosmic rays without this solar modulation. So here is AMS and PAMELA data, and then up here is Voyager data. So we can get a better idea of how the spectrum changes between a few GeV and MeV energies. And so these cover things on the order of MeV to GeV energies. And if you want to convert that into a gamma factor or speed, you get up to 0.993 times the speed of light. We'll mostly not be talking about these. So we're going to be talking about things that are basically just going super, super, super fast. Okay. Okay, here we go. So high energy cosmic rays. So that's basically your GeV to PeV energy cosmic rays. PeV would be 10 to the 15, which is the knee. And it's long been hypothesized and has been confirmed in the last couple decades that supernova remnants are probably responsible for the acceleration of most of these types of cosmic rays that we detect in the galaxy. You also get pulsar one nebulae accelerate mostly leptrons, so electrons and positrons. We're unsure if they accelerate protons at all. As Fermi confirmed in the last couple of years, novae make, they've been detected in gamma rays, so they must make cosmic rays of some kind. And the prime example, of course, this is a pulsar. Wind Nebula is the Crab Nebula. This is our first ever high-energy gamma ray source detected in 1989 by the Whipple 10-meter Cherenkov telescope. And you can see here, across the whole radio spectrum, not radio spectrum, electromagnetic spectrum, you can see it in the radio, you can see it in visible and gamma rays. It's more than a point source, but right, there's not a lot of definition there in comparison to some other things. So that's mostly the central source there. And these are just examples of spectra of different supernovae that we've measured in gamma rays. You also get radio emission from supernova remnants, so that means we know that they accelerate both leptons and hadrons. At least we think they accelerate hadrons. There's a couple in here that they, Fermi says, we've detected the pion bump. I'll get back to that in a few minutes. Right. So those are mostly what we're going to be talking about later in the talk. But continuing on down the spectrum, there are ultra-high-energy cosmic rays. So these are the extragalactic ones, right? So that's things above 10 to the 18. And so you can see here the knee, the second knee, and the ankle. And up here, the highest energy cosmic ray ever detected was 3 times 10 to the 20 electron volts. Basically, we have a high energy cutoff here. Based on the data, it is unclear whether or not this is because the accelerators finally run out of energy, or if it's the GZK cutoff. The GZK cutoff is basically cosmic rays interacting with CMB photons, creating a turn down. We just don't have enough data to be able to distinguish between the two possibilities here. And we do know that as you move to higher and higher energies, you transition from proton-dominated to heavy element nuclei-dominated iron, mostly. But the specific composition percentages of these different components depends on cross-sections, which we don't know super well at ultra-high energies. We know things from the LHC, which is somewhere over here. And so you've extended those cross-sections to ultra-high energies. And so this is probably fairly representative, but not necessarily. It's representative in that you're transitioning from helium to iron nuclei, but the specific percentages there is still sort of model dependent. There we go.
Is there some reason to expect, you know, the emitted spectrum to cut off there, or I mean, like
this thing?
No, the GZK feature might not be a GZK feature, you're saying.
It could just be that the accelerators have run out of steam, right? But we don't.
There's no reason to think that they would stop at 10 to the 20 versus 10 to the 19 versus 10 to the 21.
I'm not sure exactly. All I know is that from what we have, you can't tell if it's one or the other. Basically, there's not enough information from the data to say specifically it is the GZK.
There's no reason to expect that it might not be.
I don't know exactly, yes. So I'll get back to you on that. And one of the candidates for these ultra-high energy cosmic rays are AGN, so supermassive black holes in the centers of galaxies and their associated jets. I think this is Centaurus A. Yeah, that's an A. So here's one of the things they have done to see whether or not ultra-high energy cosmic rays are related to AGN. AGN, so the blue stuff is just the sensitivity of whichever detector this is, probably Ogier. AGN are the red points. The circles in black are the cosmic rays. So, like, there's lots of stuff around them. Some of them overlap. But we're really not sure. There's not enough data, really, to get a super good correlation there. The theory of AGNs comes from a plot like this. This is the Hellis plot, where you plot sort of the magnetic field strength of different types of accelerators versus the size of these types of sources. And then you have constant lines of energy. Here is a proton of energy 10 to the 21, and here is an iron nucleus of energy 10 to the 20. So AGN fits right in that nice sweet spot. Supernovae obviously don't make it. Although recent analysis of the Auger and other ultra-high-energy cosmic ray data shows that perhaps starburst galaxies may be favored as sources over gamma-ray observed AGN. Okay, so got them from all these different sources. How do we study them? So one of the ways we do this for Auger and other types of ground-based detectors, cosmic rays come into our atmosphere and they hit a nucleus and they create a shower of particles. So you get kaons and pions and other related things. They decay into muons and you can detect those. You can also detect the neutrinos that come off that. That's the muon component. The nucleus itself and the initial proton continues down in a hadronic cascade. So you get protons, neutrons. All of these particles have charged and neutral associated particles. They decay into things. Muons themselves also decay. The neutral particles decay into gamma rays, which creates an electronic cascade. Basically, the gamma rays pair produce, and then the electrons and the positrons create more gamma rays, and energy swooshes back and forth. And the muon decays into a positron and or an electron, depending on the charge, and another neutrino. So you get lots of different types of particles out. Yes, that's the electromagnetic cascade. Right, so these are the different types of particles. And then in addition to that, you get lots of radiation. So you get UV fluorescence, you get Cherenkov radiations. That would be when for example, a lepton is traveling faster than the speed of light in whatever medium it's in. So speed of light in air obviously is slower than the speed of light in vacuum, and the electron is traveling fast enough that it's faster than the speed of light in the medium, which creates Cherenkov radiation, which is given off at a specific frequency and a specific angle. And then you get gamma rays. Right. And so here are examples of detectors. So this is CREAM. This is a balloon-based experiment. We're still using balloons. Then there is PAMLA. It's a satellite. Voyager, as I mentioned, is still super useful. There is ground-based Cherenkov detectors. This is HAWK. It studies both gamma rays and cosmic rays. And then there is IceCube. On top of IceCube is a neutrino detector. On top of IceCube is IceTOP, which is what they use to basically rule out cosmic rays, gamma rays, muons, all the stuff that's not neutrinos. But handily enough, it means you also have a cosmic ray and gamma ray detector right on top of your neutrino detector. And then this is telescope array, like Auger. This is built to study ultra-high energy cosmic rays, and I believe this one is in Utah. Auger is in South America, Argentina, I think. Okay, so cosmic rays are cool. They have lots of information, but they're isotropic to one part in a thousand. So we don't know where they come from. We can't trace them back to the initial direction in which they are, initial source they came from, because of the galactic magnetic field. So this is a Planck map of the magnetic field. So this is polarized emission from dust. And so they get all tangled up in the magnetic fields and change directions. And so we can't trace them back to wherever they came from. So I said one part in a thousand. There is a very, very slight cosmic ray anisotropy, as discovered by many of the various Cherenkov-based ground arrays. This is some of the most recent data on this by HAWK and the IceCube collaboration. So there is a large-scale anisotropy and a small-scale one. So you can see sort of the dipole here, and then you can see a bunch of like the smaller variations. Probably at least some of this is related to the magnetic field of the sun, so the heliopause, but we're not entirely sure what all is going on here to create this anisotropy. So regardless, you can't trace cosmic rays back to their source, unfortunately. So we have to make do with things like gamma rays and radio emission and neutrinos. Gamma rays and radio are pretty awesome. For the most part, they don't get absorbed, but occasionally they do. But gamma rays are really hard to detect from star-forming galaxies because just not enough of a signal. Neutrinos are really hard to detect, period. and we've only got one source. Okay, so cosmic rays. How do we get these gamma rays, neutrinos, etc.? So cosmic ray protons interact. Okay, so galaxy. It's a big disk. There's a halo. That's unimportant right now. And there's a bulge in the center. There's stars, there's gas, there's magnetic fields. All very interesting things. There's photons, all kinds of radiation. So cosmic ray protons are sort of moving through this mess of stuff and hit interstellar medium, interstellar gas, molecular hydrogen mostly. And when they do that, they make pions, and pions decay into charged particles, as we established before, and gamma rays. And so we can measure these gamma rays. And then for leptons, electrons will interact with just your regular nucleus floating around and get accelerated and make gamma rays. That would be Bremsstrahlung. And they also interact with photons. So an electron can upscatter a low-energy photon into a gamma ray. This would be the inverse Compton effect. Additionally, these are all charged particles, and the electrons are light enough weight that when they're interacting with the magnetic field, they emit radio synchrotron emission, right? So this is the map of the galaxy in gamma rays. Looks very similar to that dust polarization map we had. This is mostly, I think it's 0.1 to 100 GeV. And this is 9 years of Fermi data, which is pretty great. So you can see the galactic plane. This is Cygnus X. So that's basically looking right down a spiral arm. Over here is another spiral arm, I believe. There are a couple of galaxies you could probably pick out somewhere. Among them are the LMC and the SMC, a bunch of, basically, Fermi is a pulsar and blazar machine. It's mostly what it detects. And in addition to that, there's a handful of star-forming objects, star-forming galaxies. So, what are we doing? Okay. Put a bunch of stuff up. What are some questions of specific interest that we might want to address if we're looking at cosmic rays and external galaxies? Well, how do we study them in other galaxies, right? What can gamma rays and neutrinos tell us? We've had radio detections for a long time, gamma ray detections for not very long. So what is the new information we're getting there? I said the energy is equal to that in all these other things for the disk of the Milky Way. Is that true in other galaxies? Is that true on smaller scales? Great. And what are the accelerators? Don't think I address this a lot. No, I do, a little bit, okay. Can we use gamma rays to distinguish between star-forming activity and AGN activity? The answer is yes. Okay, so here is multi-wavelength Milky Way. You've probably seen this before. Here are the gamma rays down here. So you can see the difference between this map and the one I just showed you. This is the EGRIT map from the 90s. So we got a lot more information with Fermi than we did with EGRIT. This is radio emission up here. And you can see, for the most part, you can see all the same features in most of it, not in the near-infrared of the optical. So the black stuff here is dust, which is why you can see it in the infrared, I think, and not in the optical. But basically, you have the disk, you have two spiral arms that we're looking down. And this is cosmic ray electrons, and this is largely cosmic ray protons. So all of that stuff translates into observational information about the galaxy itself, right? So the radio tells you about the magnetic field, it tells you about the cosmic ray electrons. Unfortunately, these two are basically linked. It's really hard to distinguish the magnetic fields themselves from radio emission because it's really hard to make different observations which tell you about the magnetic field by itself. Millimeter wavelength observations tell you about the ISM, molecular gas, H2. Infrared tells you about photons that are being generated by stars, star clusters, etc., and the dust. Optical observations tell you about the pressure of the ISM, and you can see galactic winds. You can also see winds in X-rays, and they tell you about the hot gas. And then gamma rays tell you about cosmic ray protons and electrons, and it tells you about the density of the ISM, because the primary target, right, is the ISM, which is what it's interacting with. And neutrinos are solely cosmic ray protons. so, if you could measure galaxies and neutrinos, that would be great, because then you could separate out the ISM from the protons, and you could separate out the magnetic fields from the electrons using the radio, the gamma rays, and the neutrinos. But that's a long way away. Okay, I'm gonna speed up. So, Starburst Galaxy. We live in the Milky Way, which is quietly forming stars at about 2 solar masses per year. So you make about 2 suns per year, right? There are some galaxies which are undergoing rapid bursts of star formation. That's why it's called a starburst. And so what's happening is that the current star formation rate is significantly higher than the galaxy's long-term average. And these are galaxies like M82 or NGC 253 are the two closest. And they've got crazy merging galaxies like the Antennae, and 1614's got this crazy dust lane coming out of the center there. So all kinds of different things. And the critical part here is the short time scales for this star formation. About 2% of massive galaxies are undergoing starbursts, which accounts for about 10% of the total star formation something distribution. There we go. Most of these starbursts are nuclear starbursts. So they're happening in the very center, a few hundred parsecs of these galaxies. So basically you have a lot of dense molecular gas, you have really strong magnetic fields, lots of photons, and highly variable star formation rates in the centers of galaxies, which makes them an excellent target for studying cosmic group populations. Comparing the energy scales briefly, actually let's skip this. Okay, so radio in galaxies. We have a power law. It's great. And the spectral index for most star-forming galaxies is at about minus 0.7. 10% of this is not cosmic rays. It's thermal. So that's ambient electrons interacting with other ambient electrons. Free emission, basically, is what thermal is. So free electrons interacting with free electrons. You get high magnetic field strengths in starbursts, not necessarily in regular star forming, but they're higher, they're more closely related to the energy in the gas than they are to the energy in the cosmic rays at this point, right? There's more of it in the magnetic field and in the gas than there is in the cosmic rays, which is a lifetime to do with how short the lifetime of the cosmic rays is. And the radio is well correlated with the far infrared emission. So here's an example. The star-forming galaxies are red. The galaxies with AGN are blue. Blue is kind of all over the place, but the red form a really nice correlation here. That would be the far infrared radio correlation. And so the first detection of a galaxy in radio was M31 in 1951. So we've been able to detect and study galaxies in the radio for a very long time. This is what we can do today. This is from 2015. This is an image with the VLA. This is M82, and you get lots of really great detail, and you can pick out specific sources, and you get the general diffuse emission as well. You can see stuff coming out, right, sort of streaming away, radio filaments. You get fantastic detail in radio stuff now. M82 was first detected in 1961 in radio. Okay, gamma rays. So the first detection of a gamma ray, of a starburst galaxy in gamma rays was 2009. In contrast, they started trying to detect them in 1968. So it took a really long time. The first detection of a gamma ray source was the Crab Nebula in 1989, right? So it took another 2 decades to detect starburst galaxies. And now that we've detected them, we've got like 10, which is awesome. And there's only 2 that have been detected with ground-based TEV energy telescopes. So Fermi does GEV energies, ground-based ones do TEV, and we've only detected M82 and NGC 253 in gamma rays at those energies. Right. Okay, I'm just gonna really speed up then. So it turns out because radio is correlated with the IR, gamma rays are also correlated with the IR, so that's what this is. Let's see. Neutrinos. We don't have them. this is the probable emission from a starburst galaxy. This is the detection limit. They make account for up to 10% of the ice cube detection, the ice cube neutrinos. I'll skip that one. So they detected R220, which is the closest ultra-luminous infrared galaxy, 2 years ago, two, three, anyway. And so it's a late stage merger. So basically it all looks like one thing, but you got two different nuclei in the center and they're both undergoing starbursts. And this was the predicted flux. And here are the sensitivity of various instruments. These data points are the actual detection. So it's a lot higher than what we predicted based on just this information from the radio and star formation alone. So if you fit a power law to the data and you put it and make a radio model, here's the amount of emission from the two nuclei. Here's all the radio emission you're predicting. So you're way over predicting the radio. And to make this level of gamma ray emission work, you need a star formation rate, which is at least, so this is like 18. The observed rate is 2 to 4. So close to an order of magnitude greater than what we see. It's got an AGN. And the AGN is behind a column of gas so thick that it's, let's see, the column density is 10 to the 26. Column density in the Milky Way is like 10 to the 21. So it's 5 orders of magnitude more dense than the stuff in our galaxy, which is why you don't see the AGN in X-rays or in the infrared. Because at that point, if you have that much gas, the X-rays are getting absorbed before they escape. Let's see, talked about energy density. So when you get into these ultra luminous infrared galaxies, these ultra dense star forming systems, the magnetic field, the energy in the magnetic field way surpasses the energy in the cosmic rays. So instead of being in equipartition with the cosmic rays, the magnetic field is in equipartition or equilibrium with the thermal gas or the turbulent field, turbulence. And this may be a function of density, the lower dense things. So the main explanation for why this happens in the disk of the Milky Way is that you've had enough time to come to equilibrium. These objects are, these centers of galaxies that we're looking at here, are few hundred parsecs in diameter. And so the time scale on which you're making cosmic rays and generating the field is much shorter than you would need to come to equilibrium, basically, right? So your cosmic rays are in a super dense environment, which means they're not living very long, right? Which means you're gonna have way less energy density in the cosmic ray, of the cosmic rays, than you are at the magnetic field. And this may be a function of the density, because the density is related to your star formation rate, right? So it all sort of runs together. So it turns out you can do a lot of cool things in all kinds of galaxies with cosmic rays. You can drive galactic outflows. You can heat the molecular gas that's making stars to prevent it from making stars. So that's a form of feedback, as is the outflow itself, right? You're getting rid of gas, you're expelling it from the galaxy, preventing it from forming stars. This is one of the primary ways in which you deposit energy into the intergalactic medium, is through galactic outflows. You can measure gas that we can't see through normal things. So most molecular gas that we measure is, we're actually measuring CO. So you can't measure H2. It's totally neutral. It's not going to do anything. So we measure CO, which is usually around H2. But there is some gas that is CO dark. And with gamma rays, you can use the what you know about the cosmic rays to tell you what the density is, basically. So you can probe how much of the gas there is stuff we can't see. We're learning all kinds of things about turbulence in the interstellar medium with gamma rays. We know that as you move towards the center of the galaxy, the spectrum of gamma rays is steeper, which means that basically you're undergoing less diffusion in the center. So all kinds of fun and interesting things. So the really powerful thing is radio plus gamma rays. Oh, forget that. Joint modeling, right? When you get the two, then you can really pin down the cosmic ray population and the magnetic field separately, which is very informative. So you can use the gamma rays then as diagnostics for hidden AGN, stuff that we can't see, which would be great if we could detect more galaxies and gamma rays, but we can't right now. So maybe they'll detect M51 before Fermi's done. We'll We'll see. And, right, so the energy balance in nuclear starburst, there we go. The energy balance in nuclear starburst is very different from what it looks like in a galactic disk. And I didn't really talk about this, so there we go.
Thanks. Questions for somebody? That's a question. So you're showing this dipole in the cosmic ray distribution.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned this is somehow related to the sun's...
It might be related to the heliopause,
is
right?
The direction of the dipole, like, is the direction the same as like the sun's motion or something? Or
I think I haven't really kept up with this in great detail. I just remember that there were several models floating around about how cosmic rays would move in the local solar magnetic field. So, yeah. But I can point you to some references.
Okay, cool.
So,
if you look at the total gamma ray flux, what is approximately the percentage of the different contributions of the different origins from proton-proton collisions and electrons?
So, in star-forming galaxies, it's dominantly neutral pion decay. So, it's mostly protons. Right? There is a small contribution from Bremsstrahlung and inverse Compton is in there a little bit, but it's not doing much of anything. If you were measuring gamma rays at MEV energies, you would mostly be looking at inverse Compton and Bremsstrahlung, and that would be really interesting. But we don't have any instruments currently that can do that. I think there are proposals for two of them, one from NASA and one from ESA in the works, E-AstroGam and AMIGO. Are the names. Basically, the last time we had an MEV energy gamma ray detector was when EGRT was up. So EGRT was on a satellite with a bunch of different things on it. But MEV is where you would study inverse Compton, synchrotron, or Bremsstrahlung. Which of those sort of the dominant contribution in hard X-rays would be interesting. There are a few measurements from stuff like NuSTAR, but it's a little lower, really. There's not as much data just because of the sensitivity and the amount of emission being produced in starbursts. But at GEV energies and TEV energies, it's protons, it's neutral pion decay.
Okay, great. So there is coffee waiting for us, I think, downstairs. So let's thank Toby again.